War of 21st Century Plague, the story of SARS. And by the way, I checked the Amazon.com listings for your book, and there's only one copy left on Amazon.com. So get out there, get the last copy on Amazon.com. Just back from Geneva, where he worked very closely with Dr. Margaret Chan at the World Health Organization. And op-ed page, if you haven't caught your weekend edition of the Herald Tribune, there's his article there a day before yesterday, all of which leads up to the issue of swine flu, a.k.a. H1N1. So much publicity, and yet when I didn't get it, I wondered if this was the pandemic which cried wolf. Well, to disabuse us of such notions and give us an insider's view of the WHO and its handling of H1N1, I ask you to welcome Thomas Abraham. Thomas?
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for revealing my darkest secrets in front of an intimate group of 50 or so. But yes, I watch Bollywood films. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And I hope to answer some of the questions that you raised in your introduction about the pandemic itself. In January 2009, I took a year off from the University of Hong Kong, where I teach, and went to work at the World Health Organization in Geneva. I went initially to work with a man whom I greatly admired, a man called David Heyman, who is one of these legends in the world of global public health. When smallpox was eradicated, he was out there vaccinating people in the most remotest villages in India. When Ebola broke out in Africa, he was there. A legend. And initially, what I wanted to do really was to work with him and perhaps think of a second book and so on and so forth. However, things did not quite work out that way. And I was soon drafted to work in Margaret Chan's office as the head of news and media relations for the WHO. And this is not because I knew Margaret Chan before or because of my Hong Kong connections, probably quite the opposite, but there were very few people in the WHO at that point of time who had any clue on how to handle the media, who had any media experience. So it was in this job that I found myself on the 24th of April, 2009, a time when I think one of the most exciting periods in my life, my professional life, opened up. And let me tell you the story of what exactly happened on the 24th of April and subsequently. Like all good stories, this story begins with a telephone call at midnight, right? And the man who received the telephone call was this man. His name is Keiji Fukuda. He is a Japanese-American who worked for many years in the U.S. Centers for Diseases Control. He is one of the world's biggest experts on flu, and before April, he was head of our global influenza program at the WHO and an assistant director general. He's quite well known here in Hong Kong. I mean, he came to Hong Kong in 1997 for the first avian influenza outbreak. He was here during SARS and so on and so forth, and a wonderful person to work for. So KG receives this phone call, and at the other end was this woman. Now, her name is Dr. Nancy Cox. She works for the U.S. Centers for Diseases Control. She is one of the world's experts, once more, on influenza. And she heads the CDC's influenza program. Why did she call him at midnight, especially early on a Friday morning? And what did they talk about? Now, here's what had been happening. Around March, starting the end of February, March, there had been these unusual outbreaks of influenza in Mexico. And why were they unusual? The normal flu season in Mexico ends by about December. And by January, February, you find very, very few cases. Instead, you saw this sudden flare-up of disease activity February, March, April. There were at least three places in Mexico, including Mexico City itself, where there were a large number of cases. Mexico City, I think by this time, had about 800 cases hospitalized, about 54 deaths. It was unusual, and people were getting really worried. The Mexican government, they were trying to figure out what this disease was. At first, they thought it might be SARS. They tested viral samples for SARS, no SARS. So they sent their samples to Canada, to a lab in Winnipeg for testing. At the same time, around the same time rather, the US CDC were doing these sort of routine flu surveillances, and they picked up seven cases, two in California and five in Texas, with a strange flu bug, a bug that they had never seen before. So they put it through their labs, they sequenced them, and they found, this was an unusual flu bug. By this time, they had also got samples from Mexico, and they found that the Mexican virus and the virus that was in California was the same thing. So you had a previously unknown flu virus causing disease in at least two countries, causing fairly large pockets of disease. People were getting hospitalized. It was getting pretty serious. And it appeared to be spreading easily. The big question, and this immediately set alarm bells off, right? The big question the flu experts asked themselves was this the so-called big one? Now, what is the big one? Flu experts for decades had been predicting that a new influenza pandemic was going to break out sometime, probably sooner rather than later. And they pointed back to the big epidemic that we had in 1918, and they said this could be really serious, do prepare yourself. And for at least 3 to 4 decades, a network of laboratories around the world had been testing influenza cases, sequencing viruses, trying to find out whether a new virus had got out into the human population. And I'll talk a little bit later about why this was such a big deal, right? But the minute that the WHO, the CDC, the Mexican government by now had also started, they were issuing press releases and press conferences. Canada had issued a travel warning against people coming from Mexico. So a lot of things suddenly started happening. So what KG did was he picked up the phone in turn and called another woman. And that was this one, Margaret Chan. Margaret Chan at this point of time was somewhere over the Atlantic. She was flying to Washington, D.C. for a conference on malaria. So he left a message for her on her phone. The minute she landed in Washington, she got the message, and she immediately got on the phone to the Mexican government, the U.S. Department of Health, which at that point didn't have a health secretary yet because Kathleen Sebelius had not yet been confirmed. She spoke to regional offices, et cetera, et cetera, and she quickly decided, forget the malaria conference, I'm flying straight back to Geneva because I think this is big. In the meanwhile, all of us had also been woken up, and the WHO's so-called war room, its Strategic Health Operations Center, was activated. And what is this? This is what it looks like. And this room on the ground floor of the WHO headquarters is basically where the entire the H1N1 operation was run from. This is a photograph of our 8:30 morning meeting, which is when all of us sort of gather around to get the latest news. The people sitting around those tables in front of the computer monitors, this gives you a good idea of what exactly the WHO was doing at that point of time. You will find there doctors, clinicians who are trying to get as much information as possible about the clinical symptoms of the disease and try to find out the best way to treat this. You will find epidemiologists who are trying to chart the spread of the disease, as, if you will. You will find logisticians and experts in logistics because one of the first things the WHO would need to do really was to get supplies of antivirals like Tamiflu to countries that needed it. So these were the kind of people who were sitting around. They spent most of their time on the phone getting information from the field. When they did get information, it was displayed on those big charts that you see on the background there. And so this shock room, as it was activated, and it stayed, it worked 24 hours until sometime in July, almost nonstop. And all of us were really working on 24-hour shifts. Margaret Chan comes back. She gets back at 8 in the morning on Saturday, comes straight into the office where all of us were working, and this is what she plunges straight into it. Now, one of the big questions people always ask me is, what was she like? Was she good at her job? What was it like working with her? Now, I think to understand Margaret Chan's response to SARS, to H1N1, you needed to be from Hong Kong. And you needed to understand the criticism that she and the government came under during SARS, right? When the general belief was that the government had really messed it up, they hadn't reacted quickly enough, and so on and so forth. And she clearly was battered and bruised by this. She moved on to the WHO. And when this happened, I think, and this is my reading of her, she was determined to make sure that nobody ever criticized her for not doing enough, right? She plunged into it, and she really was a hands-on general. She said, listen, this is important. We are going to be...
Make you louder.
I'm sorry. Can I be... Can you all hear? Yeah? Sorry about that. Okay, how's that? And she was determined from day one to be out there in the middle, right in front, to make sure that the WHO took leadership for this and that the WHO was not criticized for not doing enough. The WHO has, to an extent, she succeeded. The WHO has not been criticized for not doing enough. Instead, as we shall see towards the end of this my talk, it has been criticized for the very opposite, that it did too much, that it overreacted. And that brings another set of problems which she, I think, is going to have to handle. But she was very much there. It was her, because of her experience in 1997 during the first bird flu outbreaks and her experience in SARS, she was, I think, uniquely qualified to sort of understand what a pandemic was all about. And she used to keep telling us, you guys are all theoreticians. I'm the only one who's been out there in the front line. And it was true. The guy sitting next to her, this is a Sunday, which is why they're always all dressed the way they are, is the Deputy Director General from Ghana, AB, who was a sort of number two and running a lot of the operations at that point of time. She came, she was determined also to go public very, very quickly. And this also, once more, I think, is a response to her SARS experience. And so that evening, we organized a phone-in press conference for her. And subsequently, we used to have daily press conferences, and I think we were really upfront in terms of releasing news about how this pandemic was evolving. I think we all know the story, and these are pictures really from Mexico, which were taken by WHO photographers. And the reason I'm showing you these pictures, really now, when we look back, we often ask ourselves, was this such a big deal? But look at these photographs, and I think they really reflect the emotional impact that this had. These are people down on their knees, right? Because they've never seen anything like this. Here's another photograph from inside a cathedral somewhere, and these are people who are praying with masks around their mouths, right? And why were they doing this? Because people were falling sick. People were dying. Young, healthy people were falling sick and dying, and nobody was quite sure what this was all about, right? So this was definitely a real pandemic. A collection of headlines, really, I want to talk a little bit about what dealing with the media was like. And here's some of the typical headlines that we saw. And I want you to compare these three, really. And this is, I'm putting on my Hong Kong U Journalism Center hat here. This was at the end of one of her press conferences. The headline on top, WHO chief says swine flu has pandemic potential, came from one of the wire services, and it's basically a good wire copy, straight down, nothing blown out of proportion. The other two come from newspapers, one in the UK and one in Australia. And you look at the words there, fear, killer flu, right? Deadly swine flu, can't be contained. And by the way, these are not downmarket tabloids either. And these are serious newspapers. And we were often accused, the press is often accused of hyping up things. We were accused of hyping up things. And I think there's an element of truth in both, because when you look at these headlines and you look at some of the words there, clearly it is setting a context within which the disease, a context within which people were perceiving this disease. I was a journalist for many, I'm sorry to bring myself into this picture, but I think it's important because I think one of the key things for me really was moving from being one of those guys, right? The ones with the microphones and the notebooks in their hands, to being one of these guys, the guy who's actually giving a spokesperson, from being a journalist to a spokesperson. And that was a really, really interesting experience. Geneva has got a large international press presence there. They're based in the UN offices in Geneva. And actually, about 10, 15 years ago, I was one of those people. I was actually a correspondent based there, and it was really, really interesting. What was it like? For the first week, it was overwhelming. Our phones were literally ringing off the hook 24 hours a day. And I'm not exaggerating. The landline, the mobile, they were going nonstop. And it was absolutely impossible to cope with the demand. Because you spend 3 to 4 minutes on a phone call. Another 10 phone calls are backed up on your mobile in the meanwhile. There's no way you're going to be able to answer all these questions, and I think we annoyed the press corps across the world. And the first sort of blowback was that, you know, the WHO, you guys don't even pick up your phones, you're completely unresponsive. It's not, yes, we weren't picking up our phones, and the reason was that we just didn't have enough people at that point of time, and we just could not cope. The questions themselves at that point of time were relatively simple. What's going on? What time is the press conference? Is Margaret Chan going to say anything? What are the figures? And of course, the one question which was easiest to answer is, can I have an interview with Margaret Chan? I'm going on air in a couple of hours' time. That was a quick no. So the questions themselves were relatively easy. They were simple. They were straightforward. The volume of calls was something we were completely unprepared for. And it took us a couple of weeks, I think, to get our act together and to have weekly press conference, I mean, sort of daily press conference at a particular point of time to which people could phone in from all over the world and sort of meet the flow of information. While the questions were generally easy, they were not always so, and even the simplest of questions were often very, very hard to answer. And let me tell you why. Let me give you an example. About 4 months ago, in October, the Norwegian government, a group of scientists in Norway, held a press conference, and this typically happened on a Friday afternoon, right? Everything happens on a Friday afternoon, announcing that they had taken viral samples from a number of critically ill patients, some of whom had subsequently died, and they found that a large number of these viral samples contained the H1N1 virus with a particular mutation, a mutation called 222G, right? And so the Norwegians informed us, we saw the first wire stories, and clearly we knew we were going to be inundated with phone calls saying, what do you think about this? Is this true? Now, the fact of the matter was, yes, there was, the virus was mutating, right? But we had also found the same mutation in a large number of cases which were not serious. People with mild illness also had these viral samples. We had seen this mutation from about March, April onwards, right? But getting this across to the public required some thought for two reasons. Reason number one, we had been consistently saying that there has been no significant change in the virus, right? So we had been saying this, and then Norwegian researchers say, yes, we have found this mutation. And then we can't go back and say, yes, we found this mutation in March. And obviously, the obvious question, why didn't you tell us before? And the reason we didn't was because this wasn't very significant. You had found this both in mild cases and in severe cases, and it didn't really seem that important. But the big danger for us really was three types of headlines. One is, virus has mutated, severe illness caused. That's scenario number one. Scenario number two is that Norwegian scientists find mutated virus. WHO dismisses concerns. Headline number three is that Norwegian scientists find new virus. WHO says we knew about it all along. Three nightmare possibilities, right? So which is why just saying, hey, this is no big deal, we knew about it, is not enough. So we spent a lot of time before finally deciding what it is that we were going to say. And what we said, first of all, was, yes, Norwegian scientists have done a great job. We are really thankful that, you know, their surveillance is so good and that they've been able to actually detect these viral mutations. This is really, really important information. Then we said, our labs around the world actually have been working very hard as well, and they have also found the same mutation. And in fact, they've found it for several months now. And our information is that this does not really lead to severe disease. And point number three actually is the most important of all, and that is that even with this mutation, the virus still responds to Tamiflu and the vaccine. And that really is the important thing, because even if there is a mutation, it becomes important only if your current drugs no longer work. And so the important thing for us really was to get out this message that, yes, there is a mutation, viruses mutate all the time, but the drugs still work. So we spent a lot of time really working on this, and then we responded to calls, went out to the press and talked about this, and the response was pretty okay, I thought, in the end. But this is just to give you an example of the kind of challenges that you face on the other side. Which brings me, I'm going to end quite soon, but I have, my experience over the last year has left me with two observations that I will share with you and a question which I will pose to you. The first observation is something that as a journalist, it really heartens me, and I think all my colleagues who are here as well. I mean, having worked in this profession for 25 years, there are times when you doubt what you are doing, right? Is this really important? Does anyone give a damn what you write? And the answer is yes. It was only when you're on the other side that you see how important good journalism is. It's only then that you realize how seriously good journalists are taken, right? But there's a caveat to this. The ones who are taken are well-informed, intelligent journalists. Those who know what is going on, those who know their subject, those who've read, they know the fact, they know the figures, they've been following this for a while, and you really take them seriously. And even when we were deciding what to say, should we say this about this? And the first thing is, oh, if you say this, these guys are going to shoot you down. They know better than that, right? And it really keeps you on your toes. And it is such an important institution, the press today. It keeps you honest. I think shortly before I left, one of the big issues that one a newspaper, I think in Denmark, had brought up really was on WHO has a number of outside experts, right? Because we're a small organization, or the WHO is a small organization, so for most things, you depend on outside experts. Many of these experts also have consultancy contracts with the pharmaceutical industry, right? And so there were inevitable questions of conflict of interest. And there were journalists who went to our website, and all this information is publicly available, but there were those journalists who went to the website, looked at the names of the people who were on our various advisory boards, looked at their other interests, and came back and asked questions. And that immediately wakes you up, and you realize, hey, we need to do more about this. Not that there were any sort of blatant conflicts of interest, but this suddenly wakes you up, saying, as a public institution, we really need to do something about this. Not something we'd even have thought about. I really can't overstress how important good journalism is. At the same time, I cannot overemphasize how terrible poor journalism is. You get journalists who have no idea of their subject, They ask questions which tend to be meaningless because they don't relate to anything that's going on at this point of time. And what happens is you spend a lot of time answering these questions, right? And the kind of stories that appear tend to divert public attention from the real issues, right? And some of these were, was the H1N1 virus something that was cooked up in a lab and let loose on the world? And the answer is no. And why do we say no? Because if you look at the genetic sequence and so on, this clearly is a natural thing, right? But once this gets out there, once it's in blogs, once it starts circulating, you spend an enormous amount of time answering a question which really is a non-question, right? And so that's observation number one. Observation number two now is that diseases are about public health and medicine, but they're also about politics, and perhaps they're above all about politics. Call me naive, if you will, but until recently, I didn't realize how sneaky governments can be, right? This disease was about so much more than disease. It was a test for every government that wanted to be elected or wanted to be re-elected. How well are you doing on this, right? How well are other countries doing on this? Are we doing better than them? What is the WHO saying about what you're doing, right? This was all important. And governments would pretty much do anything to massage public perceptions of what it was they were doing. And let me give you an example. I started with the events of April, and from April, that last week of April, we moved fairly rapidly up the scale, our pandemic preparedness scale, from 3 to 4 to 5. We were one step short of 6. 6 is a full-blown pandemic. And it took us from April until early June to go from 5 to 6. Why was that? Two reasons, actually. One was, well, the virus was traveling pretty slowly. Number two, no government in the world wanted to be the country that had so many cases that it finally tipped the world into a pandemic, right? And there were a number of cases, countries where cases were growing. There was the UK, there was Spain, other countries in Europe, there was Japan, there was Australia. All of these, because the disease was spreading, it was seeding itself, it was spreading in a number of countries. No country, and every country was looking over its shoulder at its neighbors to see how many figures are these guys releasing? How many figures are they saying they have, right? Let's not be the most. Let's calm things down. And this happened consistently until finally in July, the situation became so ridiculous that it was decided to declare a pandemic, not on the basis of any one or two countries suddenly having a large number of cases, but because this was all over the world now. And that kept everybody satisfied. To be honest, judging by the speed that we went through the first two phases, we could actually have declared a pandemic not in June, but about a couple of weeks earlier, I think, just looking at the evidence. But nothing in the world is simple. And this is really about politics, and it's probably something that all of you are instinctively aware of, but it really took me aback. It's something that I thought was, yes, this is probably the way it happens, but to actually see it happening that way was something that really woke me up. And finally, Jim's million-dollar question. Was this pandemic overhyped? Was this a pandemic at all? In the months that I was there, I had very little doubt. In a sense, because we were probably living in this bubble where this was the most important thing happening in the world, right? It's been about a month and a half since I got back, and perhaps reality is kicking in. And this is a question I really want you to answer, but let me wind back a little bit. In the last century, we had three pandemics. 1918, the so-called mother of all pandemics, in which about 20, 30, 40 million people died. 1957, which was far milder. This was a so-called Asian flu, in which I think about 2 million people, more than would normally have died. And the 1968 so-called Hong Kong flu, in which about 1 million extra people died worldwide because of this new virus. Yet, whenever we talked about the pandemic, it was not in terms of 1968 or 1957, our perception was always of a 1918-like monster pandemic. And this despite the fact that 1918 was a very, very unusual time in the world. The world was in the middle of a war. Social services, medicine, hospitals were extremely stressed. Societies were stressed. We didn't even have antibiotics, right? So why was this taken to be the sort of the guiding principle as far as the severity of pandemics was concerned? And I've had occasion really to think quite a bit about this in the past couple of weeks. And I think there are two reasons. And I think Hong Kong is intimately connected in both of these. There are two events that happened. One is 1997, when we had the first instances of H5N1, a bird virus infecting human beings, right? There were 18 cases, 6 of them died. This was clearly a severe influenza virus, right? All the birds, the ducks, flying, all manner of flying things in Hong Kong were culled, and the pandemic was perhaps averted. But the same bug resurfaced in 2003, spread throughout Southeast Asia. Now it's pretty much in every continent except the Americas. It's been killing millions and millions of birds and ducks, and a significant, but not huge, number of human beings. The H5N1 virus, which clearly provided very, very severe, it was a severe virus, which high mortality rates, was, I think, something that stuck in people's consciousness. And a lot of the planning was built around this H5N1 virus. The second event was SARS. SARS demonstrated what a fairly lethal virus could do in a globalized world, how quickly it could spread, right? From Guangzhou to Hong Kong to Hanoi to Singapore to Toronto, before you knew it, the blink of an eyelid, this was everywhere, killing people, sickening people. So you put these two things together, the possibility of H5N1, the possibility of a new disease in a globalized world, and you look, and the lessons that you draw from them are pretty serious. Governments around the world got into the act as well, particularly the US government. George W. Bush spoke at the White House about this as a threat, as this pressing threat. And this was also seen in the context of 9/11, worries about bioterrorism. So suddenly, flu, H5N1, went way up there in the scale of risks the global society faced. And all of the planning that we have been doing has really been based on this model. And this particular set of circumstances, right, which elevated this disease into a huge global health security threat. Huge amounts of money also went in to fighting influenza, largely from the United States, because they had the most money at that time. They saw the threat as the most severe, and billions of dollars, including a lot from the U.S. Defense Department budget, because this was seen as a security threat. All of this came together to elevate pandemic influenza into this major global threat. People forgot about the fact that you had had mild influenza pandemics as well. And we weren't prepared for that. So when in April this bug emerged and started spreading, everybody was alert. They were really focused on it. But after a couple of weeks, even in the WHO, we started looking at each other and saying, hey, what is this? Why is nothing more happening? Right? It's spreading, but it seems to be a mild illness. So what do we do now? And that's when we first started getting this pushback. You guys have gone too far. This is a mild illness. You were saying pandemic, 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 prepare yourself, you need to do this, you need to do that. And now look at this little pussycat that's come out. This is not a tiger, right? And we really didn't have an answer to that. When we didn't have an answer to that, that was when all the conspiracy theories came in. Said, you know, the only people who are benefiting from this is the pharmaceutical industry. And therefore, the pharmaceutical industry must have had something to do with this, right? And so, the circle is closed, if you will. You have a so-called pandemic which doesn't exist. You have the pharmaceutical industry which is benefiting from this. Therefore, one has caused the other. To my mind, there is no doubt that I'm going to wind up a... Tom and Jim are looking anxiously at me. I'm going to wind up in another minute. To my mind, there is no doubt that this is a real disease, right? Those whom it hits hard, it hits very, very hard. It destroys lungs. This is a lethal virus for a small number of people. But for the majority of people, it is not a lethal virus. And I'm going to wind up by saying that I need to give my answer to this really is that the way that we perceived this disease, the way that we communicated this disease, the risk of this disease was completely out of proportion to the reality. True. But the reality itself is serious. And I think the lesson from this really is that the way a disease is perceived in society is as important, or perhaps more important, than the reality itself. And this is something that those who manage disease, those who communicate about disease, need to be aware of. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Thomas. I really didn't want to... rush you, but I did want to have time for questions because I'm sure there are. We're approaching 2 o'clock, but we're going to go about 10-15 minutes longer so we can accommodate your questions for Thomas. Any questions come to mind? Yes, sir, right over here. Could you identify yourself first, please?
I'm a guest of Ted Kavoris. My name is Melvin Bazerman. Last Thursday on the BBC Hourly News was a very long news item saying that a doctor from within the WHO, and he was identified, I don't remember his name, was saying that this was indeed a conspiracy between pharmaceutical companies and the WHO. I heard no denials throughout the rest of the day or any of the other days thereafter, but that news item was repeated all throughout the day on the BBC news bulletins. Any remarks from you regarding that?
I'm not a spokesman for the WHO anymore, but let me tell you who this person was, because I actually watched this. He said this at a public hearing. I'm sorry, you can all hear, right? At a public hearing which the Council of Europe held in Strasbourg on Monday. And the person in question was the head of one of the WHO's collaborating labs, not on flu, but on something else. So he was not a WHO person, but clearly was associated with the WHO. And he has been a strong critic of this. And he is completely, he is one of those who maintain that had the only reason for this is the pharmaceutical industry. So clearly, I mean, even within the WHO, there is a lot of skepticism saying that we went far, too far. People are skeptical. However, nobody within the WHO, and this is something, I mean, I can honestly say, in terms of the pharmaceutical industry paying off people, it's really hard to conceive. And I'll tell you why. Not because people at the WHO are angels, but because they are pretty strong checks and balances. All of the advisory groups in the WHO are comprised, first of all, most of their sessions are open. A handful of people are also consultants with the pharmaceutical industry, but there are a whole bunch of other advisors who have nothing to do with the pharmaceutical industry and who are not just going to sit back and be taken for a ride, right? So I'm not sure that the WHO, I think, has denied this, and even if they haven't denied it, as far as in my mind, I don't think this is a credible charge at all.
Other questions, please? If I may take the chair's prerogative and ask a question, Thomas, to pick up on something you were writing about in the Herald Tribune over the weekend, the question of vaccinations. Who should be getting vaccinations? Right. Who is not able to get vaccinations?
Who should be? Vaccination, this has been one of the most controversial aspects, and this is something that's going to haunt the WHO, I think, in the years to come, and public health agencies, is the enormous effort that was made to produce a vaccine for this disease, and in the end, the public didn't want it. What is my view of this? I think for a small number of people who are at high risk, I think they should get vaccinated. why would a pregnant woman want to risk losing her child or her life when you do have a vaccine that will protect you? Why would anyone who is at risk of severe disease from flu not want to get vaccinated? I see no reason. There's been a lot about the safety of this vaccine, right? And people are really suspicious, perhaps rightly so, of the pharmaceutical industry and the vaccines and so on. But, you know, these vaccines have been used in several million people across the world over 4 months now. And had there been mass deaths, we would have heard about this by now. Had there been large numbers of cases of people who were falling severely ill, we'd have heard about it by now. Had this vaccine not worked, we would have heard about it by now. A part of the problem really is a communication issue. I think the Hong Kong government, despite its best efforts, is not doing a very good job in terms of communicating this issue. And to be honest, probably governments across the world are in the same situation, because there have been reports of women aborting their babies after having the vaccination. There have been reports of stillbirths after the vaccination. There have been reports of Guillain-Barré syndrome, 2 cases, I think, which is a nervous response after the vaccination. Now, the real question is, many events will happen with or without a vaccination. And many events will happen like this after a vaccination. The question is the vaccine the cause for this? And that really is the question that we, including journalists, should be asking ourselves. Sure, people fall ill after a vaccination, but did the vaccination cause this illness? And to be honest, there is no evidence of this having happened so far. But it's definitely something that I think we need to keep our eyes on. I think journalists really need to be focused on this. There's a lot of data coming out, most of which is published in journals like the New England Journal of Medicine and the Lancet. I think the journalist community really need to focus on this. There's a lot of evidence. I mean, the vaccine trial, the results are all there. The US Food and Drug Administration got a website in which every event, so-called adverse event after a vaccination, is recorded and logged. I think we should look at that very, very closely. But having said that, at this point of time, there is no evidence to show that this vaccine is causing any serious form of disease.
Ying?
Ying Chen with the University of Hong Kong. Thomas, would you like to comment on the performance of the Chinese government and the Hong Kong government?
Yeah.
In managing the disease, the pandemic, and also the perceptions?
To be honest, I was looking at this from a distance, and the main contact I had really were from journalists from Hong Kong ringing up and saying that, you know, is the Hong Kong government doing the right thing? And is the Chinese government doing the right thing? Now, let me give you the big picture. The way I see the Chinese government response has been that during SARS, they were criticized for not doing enough. I think when this disease came along, they said, okay, they told the rest of the world, you guys say we're not doing enough, we'll show you what doing enough is. And they really went 100% to try and do whatever was necessary to control this disease. Hence you saw these quarantines. Basically they said, we're going to do whatever it is that is required to stop this disease from spreading. They launched the world's first mass vaccination program with their own, with the Chinese-made vaccine. The question has been raised, is the vaccine safe? And if it's not safe, would we know about it? My answer is that if something seriously had gone wrong in this day and age, we definitely would have known about it. The government can try and censor people, but if large numbers of people are dying, there would be text messages and SMSs flying across the length and breadth of China and over the world and across the world within hours. You cannot hide huge disasters like this. So in my opinion, I think they have reacted very, very strongly. They have contained the disease to a degree that other countries have not. Were the measures that they used excessive? Well, this is a matter of opinion, right? But I think they really have done whatever they thought was necessary to contain the disease, and they have contained the disease as much as possible. As far as the Hong Kong government is concerned, once more, I think they took a very, very firm line on this. we don't care what other people think, right? The rest of the world can do what they want, but I think their thing was that Hong Kong people expect us to control this disease. We will do whatever is required to control the disease. Hence, you had the quarantines. And this was the one time that Hong Kong really hit the headlines, and that was the tourists who were quarantined in the hotel in Wan Chai, and that sort of went around the world. But once more, in the WHO, I'll tell you, and this is not because of Margaret Chan, but since SARS, I think there is a lot of respect for the Hong Kong government and the way it handles SARS in the WHO. And this is ironical, because in Hong Kong, I mean, it is seen as this huge disaster, but in the WHO and in public health agencies around the world, people really respect what the Hong Kong government did. So all said and done, I think that they did a good job in the beginning. I think they're failing as far as the vaccination campaign is concerned. I think there's this perpetual lack of trust between the public and the public health authorities, and that itself, I think, it flows from the way that we are governed. It flows from the politics of this place, this perpetual lack of trust. The biggest failure, I think, is going to be the failure of the vaccine program. I think that is going to go back and haunt the Hong Kong government and the public health authorities there. If this virus does not become worse, then I think we're all lucky and we'll probably get away with it. If it does get worse, then I think Hong Kong probably could get hit very hard. And the fact that we haven't been able to get people vaccinated, I think, is going to have serious consequences.
This gentleman over here.
Ted Kavoris. Well, what's next? Do we all stock up on Tamiflu? I mean, was this a near miss or your conception of the future? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's a good question. And I think the what next question really is the most important question. And, the obvious answer is nobody knows. However, let me give you my take on what next. So far, this has been a mild disease. It is possible that things will change over the next 3 to 4 months because several things are going to happen. During the Lunar New Year in China, there are going to be mass movement of people, and this virus really travels with people. People are going to be moving to cities, to villages, and to more remote parts of the country, and they could well bring the disease to parts of the country that has not been there. It could grow there. It could change. The other thing that's going to happen in the next 3 to 4 months is that flu is a seasonal disease, right? It thrives in colder climates. So in the northern hemisphere, winter, it's a flu season. As it becomes summer here, the virus moves south, and the southern hemisphere starts getting cases of flu. And in this sort of hemispheric movement of the virus, once more we could see changes. But to my mind, if by December this thing is the way it is, I think we can be fairly certain that nothing much more is going to happen.
All the way back.
Martin Mertz. I was surprised you didn't mention the vaccination in the USA in 1976, which my understanding is it was abandoned because the negative effects, i.e. deaths of people who were vaccinated, far exceeded the number of people who would have died from the flu. So how is this vaccination here different from one in 1976 in the USA?
Thank you. I didn't get the full question, but I think you're asking me about the 76 swine flu vaccination. Is that right? Okay. I think this is one of the issues. 1976, there was a so-called pandemic scare, and a number of people in the United States, military recruits, got infected by a swine flu virus, and it appeared as though this was going to cause the next pandemic. Gerald Ford, who was the president at that time, went out on a limb and ordered a mass vaccination program. A vaccination was produced very, very quickly. Millions of people got vaccinated. There were a number of cases of adverse effects. Guillain-Barré syndrome, which I'd been talking about, there were, I think, a handful of cases of that, and the vaccination program was promptly brought to a halt. Will the same thing happen again? I don't think so, for two reasons. Number one, vaccine manufacturing techniques have changed a lot, and I think the initial cases in 1976 were caused probably, and nobody still knows this, by bacterial contamination of the vaccine. I don't think that can happen again. Number two, we have had several million people across the world vaccinated starting from about October, right? That's about 5 months now. And 5 months into this, we really haven't seen evidence of a huge spurt, or even a spurt in cases of GB syndrome. Therefore, I mean, if it hasn't happened so far, I think it's pretty unlikely that there are going to be serious adverse effects now.
Time for one last question, if there is anybody who hasn't been heard from that wants to. Yes, ma'am, in the front here.
Hi, Debbie McGowan, associate member. Do you think that the WHO should revisit the definitions of the scale of the pandemic, given that the six was issued, but really it's not sort of lived up to expectation?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And that is one thing that the WHO is going to be sitting and sort of scratching their heads over. And I think this is a huge issue. Was our definition of a pandemic completely wrong? Was it so removed from reality that the definition itself is meaningless? And this is something I think over the months ahead, I think a lot of people across the world really are going to be sitting down and scratching their heads and trying to figure out what is the actual definition of a pandemic. And it's a very relevant question to be answered, and there's no answer at the moment. I think this is something that needs to be reconsidered. It will be reconsidered. What the answer will be, I do not know. Thank you.
I think with that, we'll close it for the afternoon, and we want to thank Thomas Abraham for being with us. Some excellent observations. Appreciate it, Thomas. And we never have our guests go away empty-handed. This is a 9-month supply of designer face masks. No, it's not really, but a gift from the FCC. Thank you for coming, Thomas. Thank you.